Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. It's welcome to Andrew West of the Religion and Ethics Report on Radio National, our most distinguished network. Andrew, welcome.
always a pleasure to be here, John.
Now we're
on an equally distinguished program.
Thank you. We're going to be discussing some of the issues of the last few weeks in religion and what's coming up. But of course, we can't but acknowledge the deaths in the past week of Andrew Chan and Myron Sukumaran, and the funeral rites took place over the last day or so.
Yeah. I mean, big funerals for both men.
You did an interview that was...
We did. Rob Buckingham, a really impressive man. Rob is the pastor at the Bayside Church in Melbourne. His wife, Christy, also a pastor there. And he, along with the Salvation Army Major, David Soper, were really the spiritual ballast for both Andrew and Myron all during their sort of ordeal, especially the last few days, the last few years, but really in the last few days. David Soper was with Andrew Chan in the hours before he was executed, and Christy Buckingham with Myron Sukumaran. As I say, very, very impressive people, deep in their theology, but really impressive in their notion of Christian compassion. I mean, that is what really, I think, makes them new moral leaders in this country.
It was interesting to see how almost comfortably journalists and speakers and others talking on the issue began to use terms that had long been associated with religion. Words like redemption, forgiveness, those sorts of words came back into the public discourse.
Yeah. The whole story of Andrew and Myron was the story of everyone, of the fallenness of everyone, but also everyone's capacity for redemption. So yes, you're right. And for those concepts to be discussed in the mainstream, I think is very, very healthy. And aside from remembering Andrew and Myron as thoroughly reformed young men, we ought to remember the people who accompanied them on that spiritual journey. I hope we hear more of them in future. As I say, Rob and Christy, real moral leaders, and also the Reverend David Soper.
Andrew, there are other issues of the week. Islamic State, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, said to be seriously wounded. Are there implications, and are they beginning to show signs of fissures in ISIS?
Yeah, al-Baghdadi was apparently wounded so seriously, this was on the 18th of March in a US airstrike, that he has not moved in 2 months. Now, he's got apparently very severe spinal injuries that have immobilized him. All his supporters, fanatics, etc., hope, of course, that he will rise again. Very interesting, though, had he been killed, he would have become a martyr. He would have become a lightning rod for a new round of terrorist activity. There is talk that his injury will be avenged in some way. They're talking about that vengeance taking place in Europe. But there is an issue about, you know, the virility and the almost indestructibility of figures like al-Baghdadi. If he is not killed, if he is not martyred, in inverted commas, but he staggers on as a feeble leader, does that have a more, if you like, psychic impact on the broader Islamic State? That's an open question.
Yes.
Martin Chulov of The Guardian, who broke the news about al-Baghdadi's serious injury, says it could in fact have a sort of weakening effect on the troops, as it were.
Well, it invites others to stand in lieu of him when he can't do things. And that, of course, opens up the possibilities of others being leaders.
Yeah, well, he's been replaced temporarily by Abu Ala al-Afri. Interesting about him, he's a professor of physics. And I think what this points to is the complete falsity of the idea that Islamic State is only able to attract, you know, very poorly educated, people with very little Islamic literacy. For all its fanatical and psychopathic violence, it's attracting ideologues of, if you like, a very high caliber. We can loathe, as we ought, the fanatical ideology, But don't underestimate the intellectual force that this movement has behind it. That, I think that is one of the more frightening aspects of it.
Some might offer an observation about the distinction between the disciplines of the humanities and the sciences there, but perhaps we won't go down that path. Another region has emerged as an exporter of religious extremism. And this one, not in the Middle East, but an old and familiar story.
Yeah, the Balkans. Very interesting reports coming out of the Balkans, where you've got lots of religious diversity. And of course, in the 1990s, this was the place of great religious conflict, particularly in Bosnia. But Orthodox Christians joining pro-Russian rebels in the Ukraine, tending to be Serbs, Croats tending to be Catholics, joining the Melkites and the Catholics and the Orthodox who are loyal to Kiev, yeah, they're going in on the side of the Ukrainian government. And then you've got the Bosniaks and the Muslims, especially from the Sandžak region, which straddles part of Montenegro. They're going to Iraq and Syria. So, yes, a very interesting sort of exporting of this fanaticism. Really interesting figures coming out of, for example, Syria and Iraq. An author of a report there says that the Kosovars, he has identified 232 Kosovars fighting in Syria and Iraq, and they tend to be of Albanian Muslim background, 330 Bosnians, 90 Albanians, 70 Serbians, 12 Macedonians. Kosovo is at the top of a list of 22 countries when you're looking at the percentage of places that are exporting fighters to the Middle East. So, you know, the Middle East itself, not just the breeding ground for religious extremists, but this old region, as you identified, almost in the heart of Europe.
It's a story that you could trace back, couldn't you? You could go back to the way it was pre-World War I, which we're just celebrating the centenary of, but there's doubtless going to be thesis upon thesis written on that. Let's move. There's a papal statement coming up soon on climate change and a recent One Summit conference at the Vatican, convened by no less a person than Pope Francis.
Yeah, the Pope convened just at the end of last month a summit. This was in advance of this climate change statement, this encyclical, that's likely to occur in June or July. Very top scientists, the Nobel Prize winning chemist Paul Crutzen, the climatologist James Hansen, Martin Rees, who is the former president of the Royal Society in the UK, the top scientific
Astronomer
body
Royal,
there.
I
Astronomer
think.
Royal, that's right. And the Italian president was there, and Ban Ki-moon, UN Secretary General. It was helped. One of the organisers was a botanist from St. Louis, Peter Raven. And, you know, the Pope made it very clear there, first of all, that he sees no incompatibility between science and faith, no incompatibility at all. But the second point that he made was that climate change, and this will come through in the encyclical, disproportionately affects the world's poor. And that is what drives this Pope. It is the concern about the world's poor. And his visit recently to the Philippines, where he heard not only about the danger that the Philippines faces from extreme weather events, but also the countries of the Pacific, the low-lying countries of the Pacific, which could be wiped out with sea level changes. This drives the Pope's thinking on climate change. The important thing to note also is that it drives his critics mad, and many of those critics are within the Catholic Church itself. There is, of course, well-known scepticism of Australia's Cardinal Pell, now in the Vatican, albeit not in a pastoral or doctrinal role, but an important role nonetheless. In addition to George Pell, though, Lord Monckton, that very colourful climate change sceptic, he is a devoted Catholic, but he is a doubter. And, of course, you've got this legion of sceptics in the US Republican Party.
And of course, the Pope is about to go to the United States comments on climate change.
Yeah, but you've got a legion of sceptics in the Republican Party, most prominently the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, who is a Catholic. You've got a number, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, a convert to Catholicism. All of them, at least, have to pay lip service to the Republican dogma that is sceptical of climate change. But it's going to be a very interesting conundrum for those conservative Catholic Republicans about how they answer this Pope and his passionate belief that climate change is real.
Of course, one of those Republicans is a possible presidential contender. That's Jeb Bush.
Who could well be Marco Rubio.
The Pope's going to the United States. He'll place himself right at the heart of that discussion when the press want to push that issue. And, of course, the Republicans are beginning to gear up for the big fight already.
Yes, and interestingly, not just when broadening the sort of audience, as it were, now to the evangelical base of the Republican Party, an old favourite has stepped in, Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas.
Now, about whom there were all sorts of rhymes, I think, the last time he stood.
Well, I do remember the New Yorker magazine began an article in a wonderful way. It just said, Mike Huckabee, funny name, funny guy. And Mike Huckabee is apparently an incredibly affable fellow. He was a successful 10-year governor of Arkansas, really governed in a very pragmatic sort of moderate way, but a very passionate evangelical Christian, an ordained Baptist minister. That is, in fact, his profession. He was an ordained Baptist minister, then a sort of a radio minister as well, a radio preacher. He stepped in back in 2008 when he first ran for the Republican nomination, had pretty much a lock on the evangelical vote. Not so this time, because you've got some other people competing very strongly for the evangelical vote, principally Ted Cruz, a Republican senator from Texas, who talks about his own Baptist upbringing, launched his campaign at Liberty University, which was, of course, Jerry Falwell's university, and he is competing very strongly for that evangelical vote. But also Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, who is principally renowned for being very fiercely anti-union and very tough attacks on public sector workers there. He is the son of an evangelical preacher, and he's trying to meld his sort of free market fundamentalism with a conservative religious fundamentalism. It's going to play out in a very interesting way, but that evangelical vote is going to be splintered and spread in a way that it maybe hasn't been for several elections.
And it could also split the Catholic vote, of course.
It could split the Catholic vote. It could split the Catholic vote, and the Catholic vote is being courted by another candidate on the Democratic side who isn't Hillary Clinton, interestingly. Hillary Clinton may be registering 65% approval and popularity among Democrats. Maybe it's even higher. But the former Democratic mayor of Baltimore, who then became the Democratic governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, he says he's running and he's pitching for the Democratic nomination, and he's pitching himself very much as a Pope Francis-style Catholic, a Catholic strongly concerned with social justice, while trying to juggle those social questions of abortion and same-sex marriage. But what gives him, I think, the credibility of saying he doesn't just talk the talk, but he walks the walk, in that when he was governor of Maryland, he abolished the death penalty. And what did he cite for that? The traditional Catholic sanctity of life argument, the seamless garment. He says he's personally opposed to abortion, but wouldn't impose that view on the rest of the country. But he links abortion with the death penalty, euthanasia, and really likens his Catholicism to that of Pope Francis. So that is going to be one candidate to watch. If you think Hillary Clinton is impregnable as the Democratic nominee, look, maybe she is, but Martin O'Malley, and now the old fighting Jewish left-winger from Vermont, he's actually originally from Brooklyn, Bernie Sanders, are going to get, and he invokes a bit of the old Tikkun Olam, you know, the Jewish doctrine of save the world, you know, of repair the world. They're going to both give Hillary Clinton a bit of a run for her money, and they're going to invoke some old biblical concepts in doing so.
Well, let's finally turn to religion and politics in Australia. Roy Williams, the author of the bestseller in 2009, I think it was, God Actually, and then last year a book on Australian prime ministers, their history and their religious views, has a new one out, and he's arguing about the shape of the Good Society this time.
He is, and I've got to say, John, this is a fabulous book. Post-God Nation, How Religion Fell Off the Radar in Australia, What Might Be Done to Get It Back On. This is a really sweeping book. It goes, it makes a very strong argument that there's a Christian foundation for Australia, a Judeo-Christian foundation, but not in an exclusive sort of conservative way, pointing out, however, that the early settlers were driven very much by an evangelical reformist agenda, although interestingly he points out that Australia may not have been settled if the evangelical reformers in 19th century England had, or 18th century England had got their way, because they didn't believe in transportation. They believed in more humane prisons and more humane programs and the treatment of prisoners there. But nonetheless, Australia having been settled, there was a very strong evangelical Christian reformist view of how to build a colony out of redeemed convicts. But he goes on to make some very strong observations about how religion lost its prominence in Australia. Partly it was to do, in one area, particularly education, with sectarianism. It was the very fact that the churches could not agree and could not be unified across the Catholic-Protestant divide that lost them their influence in education.
Yes, the 1870s gave us free, compulsory and secular.
It did, but the secular education, as you and I have referred to before, was the brainchild of dissenting Protestant Christians. They were anxious, if you were, about Rome's influence, about Catholic influence in education. He also makes a very strong argument that war and the church's affinity with war has also undermined a lot of its popularity. Since Vietnam, most churches, most religious figures have not endorsed war and conflict. They've warned against it, especially in the Middle East. But from the First World War to the Vietnam War, the churches and some church leaders were very enthusiastic about war, almost giving it its blessing. It's a very comprehensive book. At the end of it, you're right, he also makes an argument about the Good Society based on, if you like, a Christian understanding of communitarianism, a Christian understanding that, you know, in a sense, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, that freedom can lead to a kind of nihilism as well. And whether it's a nihilism in personal morality or a nihilism in the way that we view humans as just economic commodities, that can be a very dark side of a post-Christian or a post-God world.
Andrew West, great to have you as ever. Thanks so much for joining us once again on Sunday Night.
It's always a pleasure, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.